Hi, I'm John Pasalis, and this is the Move Smartly Show. I started my own brokerage, Velocity Realty, in Toronto 15 years ago to put into action my belief that consumers with access to the right data and the right advice will make better real estate decisions. And this is important because our real estate decisions have an outsized impact on our finances and our quality of life. Now, in leading our team of real estate agents at Velocity, I draw on both my experience as a broker and as a housing analyst. In my work as an analyst, I'm frequently consulted by the Bank of Canada, the IMF, and other leading organizations looking to understand the micro trends in Toronto's housing market. Now, if you're looking at buying, selling, or investing in the Greater Toronto Area and want to set up a personal meeting with me to discuss your own real estate questions, please click the link below or visit movesmartly.com/meetjohn. If you enjoy our show and find it useful, please like, comment, and share, and subscribe on whatever platform you're watching or listening to us on. We're on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Audible as well. Our Move Smartly team will be taking a few weeks off and we'll be back mid-January. So happy holidays to you and yours. And now on to today's show. Now, as always, every month, I like to kick off sort of the mid-month with our monthly live market update. And that's really just an opportunity for me to kind of unpack some of the latest trends that I'm seeing in the market, go through some of the latest statistics, kind of talk about some of the on-the-ground trends and some of the things that, you know, perhaps are in the data that aren't obvious and aren't reported in the media. And as always, we're going to have David LaRocque joining us to unpack some of the latest trends in the mortgage market and, you know, some of the latest announcements from the Bank of Canada, what that means for interest rates, how that might impact the real estate market. So we're going to be going through all of those questions as well. As always, Ermi Desai from Move Smartly is on the live chat as well. If you have questions, please post them in the chat window. And we'll be hitting pause to answer some of those questions the best we can as well. So as always, as I mentioned earlier, for people who do have questions about their real estate decisions, always feel free to contact me at movesmartly.com/meetjohn, or you can always send me an email at askjohn@movesmartly.com. So we're going to start off by looking at the latest trends in the data for low-rise houses. Now, the trends have been pretty consistent over the past few months. I mean, things haven't changed a whole heck of a lot. I mean, there are a few things that have changed, but, you know, the first thing, of course, is just looking at sales for detached homes. They continue to be at historic lows. I mean, this month, meaning November, the only month where detached sales were lower for the month of November was actually in 2008 during the financial crisis. You know, aside from that, sales in sort of the December or November of 2023 are well below historic norms. And again, I think this is really what we've talked about in the past, just the interest rates and high home prices impacting demand and affordability. So sales for low-rise homes, in particular detached, remain at historic lows. When we look at the new listings volumes for houses, those are relatively average for the GTA. And similarly, the active listings are pretty typical. New listings, we saw just about 4,300. Active listings are about 6,800. And again, that's relatively average, nothing big there. But when we look at the months of inventory, which compares the number of sales each month relative to the number of active listings, that actually started to decline a little bit in November. Not tons, but a little bit. And we're going to talk about a little bit of the momentum we've been seeing in the market that may have caused this. But the point is months of inventory, which is kind of, again, this measure of the balance between supply and demand, has turned a little bit. We'll see if this continues into December. It's still early. It's only 1 month of data, but it's not what I expected. I mean, most of us were expecting inventory to continue, at least plateau, if not stay a little bit higher. And average prices dipped month over month to about 1.3, and we're down about 1% over last year. So average prices for low-rise homes in the Toronto area are basically exactly where they were last year. The little bit of gains that we saw in the spring when the market rallied or in the first half of this year have basically kind of disappeared, and we're kind of back to where we were a year ago. Now, when we look at the condo market, similar, slightly different trends. Sales for condos came in at about 1,200. And that is, again, well below historical norms, you know, not an all-time low. But the last time sales volumes were this low again were in 2008 during the financial crisis. So we're well below what we've been seeing over the past 10 to 15 years. Now, new listings for condos, similar trend that we've seen over the past couple of months, that new listings are pretty much at a historic high. The only year where they were higher was in 2020 when we saw this surge of investors exiting the market, partly because of people fleeing the downtown core. Rents were plummeting. People were leaving their units. Tenants were negotiating rent reductions. I mean, it's wild looking back to think about that. That was happening, and that was unbelievably almost 4 years ago. But that was the last time we saw new listings above the level that we saw last month. And similarly, when we look at the number of active listings in the GTA. For condominiums, also pretty much at a, you know, almost historic high. 2020 was the only month where active listings were higher. Active listings were, I believe, just over 6,500 or so. Months of inventory for condos was relatively flat, kind of unchanged. And prices as well were about pretty flat compared to last year. Average price for condominiums was about $730,000. Again, relatively unchanged over last year. Now, one thing I wanted to touch on that I thought was kind of interesting in the market and in the data over the past month, you know, and I wrote about it in my report where I wrote, is the housing market turning a corner in Toronto? And I don't want to say it is. Obviously, it's just 1 month of data. But I mean, to me, it's interesting because, you know, I say, is it turning a corner? Because it's not the direction that we expected the market to go in. So as I mentioned, the months of inventory looks at the balance between supply and demand, which is why I think it's a pretty good metric, because sales alone doesn't tell you the whole picture. Inventory alone doesn't tell you the whole picture. It's the relationship between the two. And when the market's cooling, we expect the months of inventory to trend up. That's kind of what has been happening over the past 4 months or so. But when we look at the trends over the past 5 weeks, inventory levels have been turning a corner. And in particular, we've probably seen a bigger decline, I'd say, in the months of inventory for low-rise homes. Low-rise homes, months of inventory peaked at about 4 months or so, just over 4 months of inventory about 5 weeks ago. And we're about 3.5-ish now, or just above that. But the point is, it's been trending down for the past 5 weeks. And one of the reasons it's been trending down, again, this isn't what we expected. I mean, I think most people thought inventory levels would stay pretty flat, if not higher, as we moved into the winter months. One of the reasons why inventory levels are cooling is partly because of what we call the sales to new listings ratio. And that basically says, okay, how many sales have we had in the market relative to the number of new listings? And if that's very low, it means effectively that sales are quite low relative to new listings. And that's what we've been seeing for the past, I don't know, however many months, a few months. But over the past few weeks, the sales to new listings ratio for low-rise houses has actually been trending up. Now, this isn't so much because of a surge in sales. We know that sales are quite low, but the number of new listings hitting the market has been cooling relative to the number of sales, which has kind of taken a little bit of pressure off of inventory levels. And on top of that, we saw quite a few investors and owners take their homes off the market last month. And that has also contributed to a bit of the decline in inventory that we're seeing. And then when we look at the sales to new listings ratio for condominiums, that has also been trending up a little bit, not quite as significantly as we've been seeing for houses, but it has been trending up a little bit, which again is a relatively interesting trend. So as we move to you know, as we move to the next couple months, we'll see how these trends unfold. It's still early days, but again, this isn't the trend that we're expecting. And to me, it's meaningful for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, sellers canceling is usually a sign that the market isn't kind of pressured or distressed. You know, someone who's really pressured to sell is not canceling their listing in November. You know, typically people take their houses off the market in December over the holidays. So November would be a pretty early time to do that. So it's interesting to see so many sellers canceling their listings, just taking them off the market. And similarly, hitting pause and not rushing to list right now and thinking we're going to list in the new year. And I'd say on the ground, that's kind of the sentiment we are hearing from a lot of sellers, that they're not in a rush. And if they can't get the price they want, you know, there's this stubborn seller who just doesn't want to budge too much. They're just going to list, you know, in the new year. And their hope is that the market is going to be a little bit busier and more competitive in the new year. And I think that's partly contributing to some of the trends that we're seeing on the ground right now. But the market remains sluggish. I mean, this is not, when I say that has the market turned, it's not a bullish comment. And the market's still very slow. Inventory levels are still high. There's not a lot of offers, but it's an interesting trend to see that months of inventory dip down a little bit. The December data is going to be very, you know, not going to tell us very much because it's usually a very sluggish month. We're not going to know what the spring market is like until probably after the first month in January. That usually gives us an indicator of how busy things are going to be. And we usually have a good sign of it on the ground. I mean, January is typically the month where we see people jump back into the market if they're buying, sellers start reaching out if they're planning to sell. So, you know, we get a good feeling on the ground of how busy we think the market's going to be even before the sales hit. So we'll see what things are like. But I mean, right now, it seems like most sellers are looking at hitting pause. And we have clients, buyers reaching out to us again who are looking at maybe jumping back in. I think the decline in rates has motivated a little bit of some people who have been sitting on the sidelines. And we'll chat a little bit about that with David as we move forward. So Ermi, I don't know if we have any questions or if we should jump over and kind of bring Dave on.
Yes, I think bring Dave in. There's some mortgage questions brewing with the news of the interest rate, latest interest rate news, both in Canada and the US.
Perfect. All right, David, are you there?
Hello.
All right, everybody. As always, we have David LaRocque from Integrated Mortgage Planners joining us today. For those of you who don't follow David, you should online at Twitter. He contributes his monthly analysis on movesmartly.com, or his weekly analysis, I should say, not monthly, his weekly posts that provide a ton of insight. And in today's discussion, I actually just wanted to go over David's latest post titled Five Takeaways from the Bank of Canada's Latest Policy Rate Decision, because I think it does give us some insight into what these recent announcements from the Bank of Canada signal. Obviously, of course, we've had the Fed Reserve's kind of announcement yesterday, what that signals. So maybe we'll kick it off, David. I think you mentioned sort of the first thing is that the bank has finished with rate hikes. So what did the bank say that kind of signaled they're basically done?
Yeah, so to be clear, the bank didn't officially say they were done. They did that in January, and the market went hog wild, and bond yields dropped in part because there was a banking, it wasn't really a crisis, but there was a banking kerfuffle happening in the U.S., which was causing a flight to safety, which earlier this year drove down bond yields. That coincided with the BOC saying that it was on pause, or that it would pause. And that created a lot of excess demand in the housing market. When people buy houses, there's a lot of other stimulus throughout the economy for housing-related items. And it basically undid a lot of the tightening that the Bank of Canada had done to that point. And the bank this time around was very careful to say, we're not going to raise rates. We recognize that inflation is now falling and that the economy is cooling off. And we like the things that we see, and they're all trends in the right direction, but we will raise again if needed. And that was a way of saying, you know, like on the old road trips when the parents would say, to the kids in the back, you know, don't make me come back there. The bank is saying, well, we're not raising. And realistically, reading between the tea leaves, we're not going to raise again. But if inflation ticks back up and we have to, we won't hesitate. So that's a way of telling the market, you know, cool your jets. Don't get too excited about this and go creating another housing rally, because if you do that, then we'll have to raise.
Interesting. Now, you also mentioned one of the takeaways is that the bank's first rate cut isn't too far off. What are the markets signaling in terms of, you know, the expectations in terms of the first rate cut and the possible number in the year ahead? I think did the Fed come out and actually say that they're expecting to cut three times? Because that's all I've been seeing everywhere.
Well, not officially. The Fed has a dot plot chart that they use, and the dot plot is basically everybody's best guess on where the rate is headed. And I think now the average dot plot forecast of the Fed's voting members says that there'll be three cuts next year. Okay. You could, when you actually take that dot plot chart and compare it to what the Fed actually ends up doing and where rates actually go, there is no correlation whatsoever. They might as well close their eyes and throw a dart at the wall for all the good that dot plot does. But my goodness, does it get a lot of play when it's released? And that's effectively what's being said right now, John. I mean, look, the Bank of Canada said in their commentary, economic growth has stalled. Higher interest rates are now clearly restraining spending. So basically, rates are high enough to do the job we intended. Business investment has been volatile, but essentially flat. The labor market continues to ease. That's the last shoe to drop. First, we had higher rates. Then we saw GDP slow. The last shoe to drop is, well, two shoes, prices and labor costs. And right now, labor costs are still averaging about 5%. They're still too high to bring inflation back down to target. But there are leading indicators. We have lagging indicators, which tell us where we've been, what's already happened. And we have leading indicators, which are more predictive in terms of where we're going. And one of the key leading indicators is, for example, average hours worked. And right now, average hours worked last month slowed. So basically, the people who were actually employed and already working were working less. And that suggests that there's additional capacity being added to the economy. We were in a state of what's called excess demand, which means there's too much demand and not enough supply. And that's a big reason why prices were going up. The bank has assessed that we are no longer in excess demand. It says indicators for the fourth quarter suggest the economy is no longer in excess demand. So the bond market is taking all of this, including what the Fed said yesterday, which has pushed bond yields even lower. And the bond market was pricing in the first BOC rate cut in June of next year. That has steadily moved up. And now there are about 50-50 odds. I haven't checked recently. They're probably better than that now. But the odds were, last time I checked, 50-50 that the BOC would move its first rate cut up till March, which is basically two meetings away. They meet next in January. Mm-hmm. And then they meet again in March. And that's basically when the market thinks the first rate cut is now likely to happen. And they're pricing it. That would be a quarter of a percent. And the market, the futures market is pricing in 3/4-point cuts next year. Now, realistically, the bank typically, when it does start cutting, cuts by more than that, especially when we've seen the sharpest series of rate hikes in modern history at a time when we have record levels of household and government debt outstanding. So it's taken a while for the economy to slow, longer than we thought. And that's caused some people to think that we'll get a soft landing. I don't think that's the case. I think the lags are longer, but the impacts will be significant and we will see a sharp slowing. So lest we get too excited, rates will be cut because the bond market thinks the economy will weaken. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we're going to see 10 to 15% house price appreciation like people have enjoyed over most of the past decade.
So that's super interesting. Now, one thing you mentioned, you kind of touched on it, is your report. You mentioned that we may see more rate cuts than are expected. And I guess, is this speaking to kind of your comment about the economy looking or potentially being worse than some people expect? Is this kind of what is leading you to think that we may end up getting more cuts than the markets are expecting or were expecting?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I predicted in my most recent post. And basically, right now, again, the backdrop is we've had the sharpest series of rate hikes in history. We had 10 hikes. The total increase took us from a BOC policy rate of 0.25% all the way up to 5%. And we've done that at a time when we have record high debt levels for both households and governments. In fact, the Globe and Mail had an article this morning saying that, what was the headline? It was basically Canadians are now paying the highest portion of their disposable income towards mm-hmm. debt on record. Mm-hmm. That we haven't seen the full brunt of that hit the economic data yet for several reasons. And I listed them in the post, three main ones. Number one, people had a lot of pandemic savings. So even though rates went up and prices were higher, we didn't see an immediate response in terms of spending activity because people tapped into their pandemic savings to maintain spending, even though costs were significantly higher. Well, there is still some saving left, but a lot less than there was when inflation really started to take off. So that made the economy appear stronger than it otherwise would have because people were tapping into their savings. Mm-hmm. But using your savings is a temporary thing. Eventually the savings run out. And one of the things we're seeing now, especially in the US, where they have even less pandemic savings left, is a big spike in credit card utilization rates. People are out of savings and now they're tapping into credit. Well, that's even more unsustainable. And that's a sign as a leading indicator of trouble ahead. In Canada, we also have had record levels of immigration. We had more immigrants last year than the US did. And that causes our headline data, like our overall GDP will grow and look great. But our GDP per capita is falling, as are our productivity levels. So yes, our economy is growing, but it's growing because we're adding people in droves and not because we're becoming more efficient or more productive, which are the healthy ways that an economy grows. So you say rates have gone up, the economy isn't slowing. Well, back out all the immigration, and the economy doesn't look so strong. Account for the fact that we had tons of savings coming out of the pandemic, that aren't going to last forever, and that credit card utilization rates, even in Canada, are starting to rise because not all Canadians have savings left over, right? It starts bottom up. The first people to run out of money are the people in the lowest quartile mm-hmm. of income, and then it moves up to the second quartile and then the third quartile. Mm-hmm. Another thing that has delayed the impact of rate hikes on the economy is those fixed payment variable rate mortgages. People's rates went up, but they were given a lot of leniency about whether or not they had to adjust their payments. So if your rate goes up and you're now no longer covering the cost of interest with your mortgage payment, but you're allowed to keep your fixed payment where it started when rates were less than 2%, then those higher rates aren't really impacting your spending yet. So elevated pandemic savings and fixed payment variables interrupted the normal transmission of interest rate policy into the economy. Mm-hmm. And that delayed the real impact. So people look around and they go, well, rates have been higher for a long time now. I know there's record debt levels, but boy, the economy looks like it's actually doing okay. So maybe we'll get a soft landing. I look at that and say, no. This is temporary. This is when Wile E. Coyote runs off the end of the cliff. You know, in those old Roadrunner cartoons, I'm going to date myself here, and his legs are pumping around and he's suspended in midair. And then he looks down and all of a sudden, boom, down he goes. So I hate to say it, it sounds macabre, but I do think we're going to see a sharper than expected slowing in 2024 as those temporary supports, the impact of those temporary supports wears off and the full impact of these rate hikes is felt. And I think the bond market sees the same thing I see. And I think that's being priced in right now, which is why bond yields, which are forward looking, are dropping, and why the bond market is now pricing in the BOC and the Fed to start cutting sooner. And I expect, even though they're pricing in 3/4 point cuts now, I think that will increase as well as we get more economic data, if it continues to show that the economy is slowing by more than we had hoped.
I mean, you touched on a lot. I'm going to talk about the bond market because I think it's important. Before I touch on that, just to expand on your point, because I think it's an important one that maybe not everyone entirely gets when David's talking about sort of the GDP per capita. This is something I touched on. I did an interview with BMO's Robert Kavchik. And you know, the idea for everyone who kind of isn't following this is, you know, the GDP numbers at a high level aren't too bad in Canada. I mean, I think we've been pretty flat over the past couple of months. So it doesn't look like we're in a recession, but this is partly, as David said, because our population is booming. I mean, when you have 1.2 million more people here this year than you have last year spending more money, that's going to drive GDP growth. But when you look at the GDP per capita, per person, it's actually been trending down. It is negative. And this is, you know, I think one of the things that Robert Kapcsik mentioned, it's one of the reasons why, you know, the economic headlines aren't so pessimistic, but on the ground, you feel it. People feel poor. People aren't spending as much. People aren't going to restaurants as much. People are cutting back. And this is sort of the difference when we look at some of these macroeconomic metrics from sort of the high level GDP to breaking it down on a more per capita basis, I think paints a more important picture. And I think, David, you're 100% right. I think we're probably going to definitely see some pressure on the market. I mean, I see it day to day. There are a lot of households who are kind of really feeling the pinch by high rates. And even with sort of the outlook of rates dropping, I mean, it's probably not going to be huge. I mean, it might be huge, but it's still going to weigh on a lot of households because our starting point from a few months ago was quite high, which yeah,
it's not going to happen in a vacuum, John. When rates drop, the economy's weakening. So people think, well, if rates drop and everything stays the same, house prices are going to go up, everything's going to be great. But unfortunately, it's not occurring in a vacuum. And the weakness in the economy that's leading to the rate drops is you know, people can't forget that that's part and parcel.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, and that weakening, you know, translates into job losses, and we're seeing it and we're hearing it kind of every other day. A lot of big institutions cutting jobs, and obviously that impacts both existing households and future buyers and existing homeowners and everything. So there are a lot of side effects that we haven't really seen yet. I think that's a great point. Now, touching on the bond market. So again, for our viewers, you know, the Bank of Canada's policy rate is really what drives variable rate mortgages. Fixed rate mortgages are driven by what is happening in the bond market. In particular, say, 5-year Government of Canada bond yields is really what drives, 5-year mortgage rates. So maybe, David, you can unpack why bond yields or 5-year government bond yields are trending lower before the Bank of Canada even cuts. Maybe just unpack that relationship for everybody and why that's happening and why we might see like a bigger drop in fixed rate mortgages before the Bank of Canada even has their first rate cut.
Yeah. Well, again, John, the bond market is forward looking. So it's always pricing in a view of what's going to happen in the future. And that's in part why the yield curve has been inverted. Normally, if you want to borrow money for 3 years, you would pay less than if you wanted to borrow money for 5 years. A normal yield curve would go like this. It would, the less time you wanted to borrow the money for, the less, you know, cost is here and time is here. The less time you borrow money for, the lower the cost. And the longer you want to lock up somebody's money, if you're an investor and you're going to lend someone money, the more uncertainty there is and the higher the rates get, the longer you lock in for. But over the last, well, since inflation took off and since the end of the pandemic, we've had an inverted yield curve. So basically what the bond market is pricing in is lots of inflation over the next year or two, and then inflation starting to really come down as we get out to years 4 and 5. So right now you pay more for a 3-year fixed rate than you do for a 5-year fixed rate, which is a sign of the upside down times we're in, because what the bond market is saying is we think that in the last 2 years of a 5-year term, the inflation is going to be less than in the first 3 years of the 5-year term. So if you just want the first 3 years of a 5-year term, ergo a 3-year fixed rate, we're going to charge you more because there's going to be more inflation over that 3 years than if you get a 5-year rate, because over the last 2 years of that 5-year fixed rate term, we expect inflation will be lower at that point. So that's the bond market looking forward. Now, we've seen a dramatic reversal. We see it today after the Fed yesterday. Last week it was the BOC, yesterday it was the Fed, and basically the bond market all summer long was marching yields higher and higher. And, you know, as a broker, I couldn't get up and make a cup of coffee without coming back to my desk and finding some lenders sending me a rate sheet saying rates had gone up. And that's now being reversed. Basically, at the height of the summer, the bond market was completely had capitulated. It was buying the warnings of the BOC and the Fed saying inflation is going to be stickier than expected. People should prepare for a higher for longer rate environment. And that was fully priced in. And then, as often is the case, as soon as there's a guy, Bob Farrell, who's a tremendous investor, and he's got his rules of investing. And one of his great rules is, and it's totally true, is whenever everyone in the market thinks one thing is going to happen, something else is going to happen. And this is an example of that. Higher for longer was fully priced in. Then we saw softer economic data. We saw some surprisingly soft inflation prints, both in Canada and the US. And the market started to move out of, investors started to jump off that bandwagon. And now everybody's rushing into the rate cuts are coming sooner than expected. The economy is going to slow by more than we thought. Inflation is going to drop sooner than we expected. And that's all now being priced in, which means bond yields, which were up here when everybody thought we were going to be higher for longer, are now coming back down. We've seen a really dramatic drop, John. We've had a drop of about 1.1% over the last 6 weeks in the Government of Canada five-year bond yield. That is a huge drop. In fact, some people wonder, you know, back when you look at the chart from January, bond yields dropped about 75 basis points or 0.75%. And we got this huge market rally. Well, now they've dropped by 1.1%. Mm-hmm. And we're not getting a huge rally. We're getting signs of strength in the market, as you said earlier, you know, or signs of recovery or signs of stabilizing, of balancing, but not near the kind of surge that we saw in the spring. And that's really for a couple of reasons. Number one, lenders take the elevator on the way up and the stairs on the way down when they cut rates. So we're not seeing mortgage rates have fallen, but not by nearly to the extent that bond yields have fallen, number one. And the other thing is, when bond yields fall by 1.1%, the most important detail is what the starting point was. Because they went up so much higher all summer, we're actually now just at the point we were at where they peaked in January before they started dropping. So that's another reason why we haven't seen the same market response now. We started at a higher starting point and we're getting down again, and lenders have to keep cutting, and they will. But there's lots of air under mortgage rates right now. Bond yields have fallen by more than mortgage rates. So people should expect to see them to continue to fall over the short term.
That's awesome. David, what a great explanation. Ermi, I want to bring you in. Maybe we can go over some of the questions. It looks like there's a few that came in.
Oh, absolutely. All right. So first of all, Dave, don't quit your day job because Zayed wants you to know that you are the GOAT.
Thanks,
Ed. For non-sports fans, that is greatest of all time. All right, so let's start with a two-parter from Riaz. I'm going to ask, I think, Dave, this first part is suited to you. And then this, oh, can you, you've got me there still? Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then, John, probably you might want to take the second half. So do you think it's fair to assume or guess that the first rate cut will be at 10 a.m. on the 10th of April, 2024. So that's the interest rate question. I'm assuming that's the Bank of Canada. And then will the freehold housing market see appreciation post-March and then for condos post-June as a result of that?
So I'll let Dave start with an interest rate prediction. He can pull out his crystal ball.
Well, right now, the bond market is betting 50-50 that we'll see the first rate cut in March. So I think if you're giving me one extra meeting and we're talking about the April meeting, I think the odds at this point, at least according to how the bond market is pricing, the odds should be good that we get our first rate cut next April. But we have to remember, guys, I can give you a very detailed answer based on everything I know about how the factors that affect interest rates are interacting right now. But you know, if Iran launches a few missiles into Israel and all of a sudden the Middle East conflict, you know, goes to another level and the price, God, I hope that doesn't happen, but if the price of oil goes to $200, all bets are off. So based on what I know today and based on what the bond market is saying, because nobody knows, for even the bond market can't predict exactly what's going to happen, but they do a better job of predicting where rates are headed than anybody else based on its track record, because it's the hive mind of thousands of sophisticated investors. I think it is very reasonable at this point, based on what we know, to expect that we'll see the BOC's first rate cut by April of next year. I agree with that.
All right, John. So then impacts on the market.
Shall
I repeat the?
Whether we'll see, was it an acceleration in the low rise market? I think was the question.
Post by March, yeah. And then for condos by June.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that happening personally. I think the most likely scenario, and again, I think this is again all conditional on where rates go. Let's just say 3-year rates, since that's the most common that people are taking. If they end up, in the spring in the low-ish fives, you'll see, I think, some more buyers enter the market. But I think that's just going to mean that, we're not at record low sales. We're still at poor sales, but just not at, 25-year plus or 30-year record low. So I think the market might be a little bit busier, but I don't think it's going to be a seller's market. I mean, I'd be surprised if it's going to be a seller's market. And certainly I don't think so for condos. So I think condo market, even in the fives, like investor demand's not going to really exist. Like the numbers don't make sense. So it's probably going to be probably a tough market for condos, probably harder than low rise. If any of the two are going to be busier, probably low rise, I would say.
All right. Thank you. Let's get to another question from Adriano. And Dave, if you could help unpack this a bit too in your answer. Is it likely that the spread between fixed and variable continues to grow? I think that means if it continues to grow, if the Bank of Canada holds the the overnight rate steady at 5%, while the bond market keeps pushing the yields down. So
sure. I understand
unpack that. I think we get it, but I barely get it. And so unpack that and maybe answer that.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. Right now, bond yields are dropping, fixed rates are falling, and that is a form of stimulus for the market. So if the Bank of Canada is worried that the bond market is driving rates down too low and creating too much stimulus and basically counteracting its effort to slow the economy and cool inflation, then the BOC might very well decide either we're going to take longer before we start cutting or we need to hike again. So what will happen first is BOC Governor Macklem, when he makes speeches, along with the other BOC deputy governors, will start trying to talk the bond market back. They'll use jawboning, it's called. They basically use their words because people know that they control interest rate policy. They might say things like, we think the bond market's gotten way ahead of itself in terms of its expectations of when we're going to start cutting rates. They actually did that earlier this year and push back hard, and that can cause bond yields to reverse and start to rise again. There's no question the BOC wants the bond market to be patient. They tried to maintain enough hawkish language to prevent too much of a drop in bond yields because they recognize that if fixed mortgage rates fall too far, that will create stimulus, drive more housing demand, create more housing-related demand, and create more upward pressure on inflation. So that is definitely a risk, and it's all about the balance. Interestingly, for Canada, our bond yields, as much as we pay close attention to what happens in the Canadian economy, there's about a 90% correlation between Government of Canada bond yields and their U.S. Treasury equivalents. We will ride in the coattails of what happens in the U.S. And in the U.S., what the Fed is saying is that we're holding now and we're now more neutral. And really, it'll be where the U.S. bond market goes that takes the Canadian bond market with it. And the BOC is watching that. And there's no question it could impact the future path of the BOC's policy rate.
All right. Thank you. And let's now get to another question that I saw related. So this is a little bit more related to the debt question, the household debt question, Dave. I wonder if you could take this one on from Connie. Credit card utilization is higher to keep people afloat as pandemic savings are running out. What other strategies are there for families to keep afloat? I really do appreciate John's comments on the fact that he's seeing this stress and you in your role as a mortgage broker talking to your clients. I'm wondering what you're seeing and what people are doing.
Well, people have to cut back on spending. Those that can are looking at extending their amortizations to lower their minimum mortgage payments. These are tough times that are affecting lots of people, and I don't want to minimize that in any way. I think the bottom line is the water is rising right now. And as I was talking about before, and one of the answers I was giving to John, the bottom income quartile is underwater now. They're tapping into debt to stay afloat, and the water levels are rising. And now we're getting up into that second quartile. And there's a level we have to get to. We have to keep the water level has to keep rising in order to bring inflation down. We've got to cool demand. And, you know, Governor Macklem has said we need the economic pain that people are experiencing, because it is a preferable alternative to letting inflation go unchecked. It's hard for people to accept that because they feel the economic pain, and the pain from inflation, if rate hikes do their job, will never be known. So people will imagine the pain they can see and touch and experience in real life is worse than the pain, and they're not going to take his word for it. This is the same guy who said that rates were going to stay low for a long time back in 2020. So what can people do? There are no magic bullets. If you have a mortgage and you've got some equity in your property and you might be able to re-extend your amortization, call your mortgage broker or whoever helped you with the mortgage. Have that conversation. Explore those options. Sometimes they can give you relief, but the reality is people need to slow their spending. And that'll bring demand down, that'll cool inflation. And when that happens, rates can come down. But until those things play out, unfortunately, it's more of the same.
And yeah, I'll add, I mean, one of course is, you know, managing your debt. Other things I'm seeing people do are trying to increase their income. Like people are who did not previously rent out their part of their home or their basements are renting them out. You know, if you can get $1,500 a month or $1,800 a month, from that's a lot of money that could be going towards your debt payment. So I think people are using different strategies to try to either cut sort of their expenses or try to find ways to increase their income by making sacrifices, doing things that they would, renting out a room in their home. I've heard people doing, you know, for a student, for whatever it is, $1,000 a month. So, I mean, again, these are not ideal for a lot of people, but, you know, if you're obviously in a very tight financial position, I mean, you have to do what you have to do to get by these tough times, I think.
Thanks, John. I mean, that's a perfect layup. I promise we did not plan this into our next question from Christopher. John, can you please share your thoughts regarding the current rental market in Toronto? It seems to have gone from being very robust from the beginning of the year to a slowdown from October to date. So if people are trying those strategies, John, how effective are they?
So the rental market is definitely slowed down. I think it's very hard to figure out how much of that is seasonal. Like the rental market always, like November, December, January are probably like the worst months to list a rental. No one wants to move over the holidays. No one wants to move in the middle of winter. Like it's always, every single year, it's terrible. So it's tough to kind of come up with some big conclusions. But yeah, I mean, to your point, yes, if you're in that situation, you're trying to rent a basement apartment, yeah, it might take you a little bit longer. More affordable rentals, I think there will always be more demand for. And usually, say, a basement apartment or a room in a home, you're going to have lineups for them. You know, it's the more expensive rentals probably that are sitting on the market a little bit longer. You know, I think there's different markets.
Thanks, John. Okay, we have one macro question that I wanted to get to. Can I insert my own?
Yes, you're allowed.
I have the conch. I have a captive audience. David and John, is it fair to say that some of the policies we've seen, both in terms of the interest rate tussle as, you know, with inflation and even QE, has it been a really unusual crisis? And I ask you this, and is this the reason for some of the wobbliness? Like we saw out of 2008, a more straightforward attempt to revive, you know, after a global crisis led by the US housing collapse. Is it because of COVID that we're seeing such a strange flight path? Or am I overreacting, David? Have we seen such a weird, a disconnect, I would say. I mean, a bounce in the bond market earlier this year led to a rip in the real estate market in Canada. And that bounce was because a U.S. bank in Silicon Valley somehow collapsed. So that led to a flight to safety in Canada. And that led to enough of a bounce so that prices started running up here. And that was in a little blip in a longer trajectory of a real mess that we've been trying to get out of since COVID. So I don't know who wants to take this. Like, are we in strange times or is that just me?
I mean, I think I'll touch on some of the things that David said. I think we are kind of in strange times. I think to David's point that he mentioned earlier, the pandemic did mess a lot of things up and it delayed the transmission that we would typically see from monetary policy into the economy and how it impacts households. Not just like, and a big part of that was, of course, pandemic savings because people weren't spending money, plus federal transfers to households. Like that was part of our savings as well. Yeah. Right? I mean, and I think that's a huge part of the story. That's a huge part of the story.
Well, John and Irby, we during the pandemic, we saw the most radical monetary stimulus that we've ever seen. We had rock bottom low interest rates. We had massive federal transfers, which is what Ben Bernanke years ago called helicopter money, which basically said, if you want inflation, all you have to do is put money directly into citizen bank accounts. Because when they were using quantitative easing and they were pumping money into the system, but it was going onto bank balance sheets, it wasn't getting lent out. It wasn't going anywhere. So it wasn't really impacting the economy. When COVID hit, they said, forget that. We're going to throw it right into their bank accounts. And then we got tons of inflation. When you think about what radical monetary policy has done, we were worried about an economic slowdown. They were worried about a depression. And so all of the monetary policy stimulus brought demand from the future forward. It basically said, we're worried we don't have enough demand now. So we're going to head into the future. We're going to grab it out of the future. We're going to plunk it down now, and we're going to make everything better, which is great. We solved that crisis, right? But now is the future. Those chickens are coming home to roost, and all of those monetary policy actions that were taking demand for the future, well, guess what? It's time to pay the piper. So do we live in strange times? We sure do. And quite frankly, there's no roadmap for what we've done. And that was what always made people nervous, is the stuff we're doing now. We can't look back 50 years and say, the last time we did this, this is what happened. There was no precedent. So they're literally going, okay, well, we're going to pull all these levers and push all these buttons and you know, do a couple of Hail Marys and hope it all works out. And, you know, here we are. So there's no question, Irby, that we live in strange times. And I think anybody paying attention would agree with that assessment.
And to be fair, I'm just wondering as well, do you think there was something about the nature of COVID in particular, the way that you couldn't actually frequent business, workers couldn't be together, that strange factor to it? So it wasn't your typical, you know, bank-led banking collapse or housing bubble collapse led crisis. There was this other element to it, which is we can't do the things we normally do business by. So we're just going to keep it going in this really artificial way.
Well, there was no lever that the policymakers didn't pull. So, you know, it was like literally Mars could have hit Earth and there wouldn't be one more
five alarm fire
would have done that they didn't do. So we treated it like a full blown depressionary crisis. And in the end, we didn't need as much stimulus as we gave the economy. And there's a cost to that. I remember BOC Governor Polaz was saying, we're trying to put out a fire and no one ever criticized a firefighter for using too much water. And in retrospect, when you actually do a little research, there's more damage done by firefighters from water than there is from the fire they're trying to put out. So it was somewhat ironic, as I read an article, a very astute person pointed that out and said, well, actually, when he said that, the facts say that actually water does do more damage. And we're seeing some of that damage. There was too much excess in the economy. And we're sorting through that now. And it's causing unnecessary economic pain. And quite frankly, if we could look back and do it again, we wouldn't do near the kind of stimulus that we did at the time. But we don't criticize people back then because we didn't know any better. They thought they were fighting off the next depression. They had trained for this moment. And when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so if you're a monetary policy guy, you slash rates, you print money. And the government throws fiscal stimulus in every direction and hopes that it's enough to stave off disaster.
Awesome. David, you remain king of the analogies. thank you. You know, it's interesting. They're still trying to determine the actual cause of COVID. And I was struck looking at Christmas book lists, because that's a gift I like to give, how little we're really seeing in terms of large tomes on the analysis of the economic treatment of this pandemic. And it was first of a kind. Obviously, if something happens again, we'll have now, unfortunately, a precedent. But I really appreciate, you know, I find it telling that we don't have a lot of that yet, that analysis.
Still in the middle of it. We're still dealing with the aftermath. I think anybody writing a book today will worry that it won't age well. I think we need to wait about another 10 years to see how this all plays out before the conclusions will be more obvious. Mm-hmm.
Very, very important to note. Thanks. Okay, let's give the last question of the year to another macro one from Riaz. You both touched on this. Do we have an issue when the population growth is 3%? We know Canada, I'm just interjecting, is embarking on a landmark population growth strategy to counter the aging population issue that many developed economies are facing. So do we have an issue when population growth is 3% and GDP is flat at 0.5%? The nation may even have consistent economic growth, but the population is growing faster than GDP. GDP per capita growth will be negative. And I'm going to give that back to you, just at first noting that Canada's lack of productivity and lack of GDP per capita growth has already been a concern.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we touched on earlier with David. And we do unpack it a bit. And, you know, if Riaz is interested in my discussion with Robert Kavchik about sort of the declining GDP per capita. And I think it is an important issue. And I think it's definitely the population boom's contributing to that. But it's not just GDP per capita. It's also, you know, when we look at wages, I mean, what happens is, of course, you know, when you flood the market with labor, salaries are not going up in Canada the way they are in the US, right? So I think it's, yeah, all of these factors are definitely kind of contributing to what is effectively, and I mean, this is an opinion. I mean, I'm not an economist. The economists who I follow have been saying this for quite some time. It is effectively like a declining standard of living. You know, because our wages, incomes are not keeping up, housing prices and costs we see are accelerating. And all of that definitely is weighing on households. I don't know if David had anything to add.
Yeah, I'd agree. I agree 100%. To be clear, I think immigration is necessary. I think we're lucky that people want to come to Canada. We have too many old people and not enough young people, and our dependency ratio is a major concern. And without tons of immigration, we'd be in serious trouble. We'd be at risk of population collapse. So I think immigration in a vacuum is absolutely economically important and beneficial to us. The challenge we have is that we don't have a housing policy that is accounting for all of the immigrants we're bringing into the country. And our housing minister and our immigration minister should go for a coffee and talk about what they're going to do together going forward. Until that happens, It's going to be harmful in lots of ways, but in isolation, no, immigration is what we need, and it's absolutely economically beneficial overall. But it's cold here. We got to put a roof over people's heads.
All right. Well, that's it, David. Am I stealing your thunder by saying the analogy I heard, continuing your firefighter metaphor, is that because our immigration minister is now our housing minister at the federal level, it's the equivalent to a firefighter who's been going around setting a lot of fires and now has to figure out how to stop them.
Yeah, great way of putting it, Irby. Thanks for that. I think you spiked the ball there.
All right. Well, it's cold here. It is December in Canada. Thank you for all your amazing questions. Stay warm. Stay by fire. Nice warm fires with friends and family. And I'll leave it to you to sign us off, John.
Yeah, we'll see everybody in the new year, second week of January. Thank you all again for all your questions and feedback over the year. Thank you, Dave, as well, for joining us. And we're looking forward to more chats in the new year.